Welcome to another edition of the Media Schwitz. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. And joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are things going there?
Hey, Mark. Things are slowing down as the holidays season starts. And there's still, of course, news coming out from all fronts. But it's certainly feels like things are winding down.
Yeah, it's definitely feels that way here too. It's like people are definitely, you know, the amount of time they're spending at work, actually doing work versus, you know, Christmas shopping or just surfing the web or something seems to have got changed considerably.
Yeah, and I am because it's a low season. I'm sort of getting even more focused on my own startup. So I'm blazing all guns on all fronts on building the product.
That's great. Can you give us a quick update or?
No.
Of course not.
but of course I'll talk about it when I'm ready to hear. I mean, where else will I talk about it? So yeah. I'll certainly talk about it here when I'm ready. But it looks like it's probably going to be end of first quarter next year as a launch.
That's great.
So yeah, it's finally happening.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking to Peter Horrocks of the BBC, and you know, we were hoping to have more kind of a UK focus on our show a little bit today. And I'm just curious about your own background because you lived in London for a while. What's your take just on how the UK media market is different from what goes on in the US?
Well, I mean, it's an extremely competitive market. It's a much, much smaller market, and it's no surprise that every British brand, or at least major British brand, media brand, both print as well as TV or online, have always dreamed of breaking into America, as they say. I mean, and this is not just a media phenomena. This has been happening in the music industry and everything forever, of trying to break into America. And typically,
it's the British invasion.
It's happened in the music industry in multiple waves. In the media industry, of course, wasn't possible before without a lot of money. Before the web, and now with the web, it becomes a lot easier. Of course, sites like Guardian have a large reach in the U.S. As much as 40 to 50% of their traffic comes from U.S. And they've tried in multiple phases, and they're trying again to sort of capitalize on that. Some of the other daily newspapers in UK, Daily Mail and Telegraph and others, are now trying in US as well. Each have their own different tactics. On the TV side, I mean, BBC has, of course, been a huge brand. Their shows are syndicated on PBS and other stations all across the country, but those are just specific shows that are there. BBC America has been there for a few years now as a full 24/7 channel in US, but that's more lifestyle, best of BBC lifestyle programming in a channel kind of thing.
Yeah. What about in digital, though, in the UK market? Because it seems like, you know, it's a smaller place, not as many people. But, you know, I remember seeing a lot of numbers as far as online advertising and digital advertising, that those numbers seem to outpace print quicker than they did in the U.S. Like, there, it seemed like there was a bigger digital uptake there, maybe better broadband penetration as well.
There's that. I mean, it's a smaller country, and there are a lot more competitors in the space. There was a deregulation that happened on the broadband space. BT, British Telecom, which is that owned all the physical lines through which broadband came into British homes, phone as well as broadband, got deregulated years ago. And since then, there's so many competitors that can build using the same lines that BT had laid to the consumer's house and build their own brand. So there's a lot of competition. And so the pricing also came down. The speeds were faster. And that's why the internet penetration was much higher, which led to these sites being saturating the market, saturation reach for most of the mainstream online brands. And so where do you go from there? You go because these are English speaking, you don't go into Europe particularly. You go into where English is spoken, and the largest market there is here in the US. So,
you know, why you know, when if everything's global, you know, and everything you get online, you don't necessarily care whether you're seeing a site, you know, that's local to you, that's in another country. I mean, you normally you're just looking at a website. It's just a website, no matter where it is. So why does something have to be necessarily tailored to your country? I mean, I can already go to guardian.co.uk. Why do I need guardiannews.com, or why do I need a BBC America? You know, why do I need something, I guess, tailored to me when I can just get the real thing?
Well, I think, I mean, part of it has to, they will say it's a business decision, because then these are packages that can be sold to advertisers.
So very quickly about the show, we'll talk about the BBC and their efforts. They just made a deal with Comcast to expand the number of homes that they're going to be in. And we'll talk to Peter Horrocks, who's the director of BBC's Global News Division, about those efforts. And then just recently we heard that one of our favorite tech sites, ReadWriteWeb, was just bought by Say Media by about $5 million. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means to them. And then we've had some really great polls over at MediaChef lately, one about cord cutting and one about gadgets for the holidays. And so we'll talk about some of those poll results. So first, let's talk about the BBC and their efforts to try to do their kind of version of the British invasion circa 2011. Major news organizations have tried many times to capture the American audience, like you said, Rafa, and, you know, have largely failed. You know, The Guardian has now set up guardiannews.com, and BBC World is pushing into more U.S. cable homes. This Comcast deal will make BBC World by the end of next year available in 15 million homes in the U.S., which is up from about 6 million currently. So let's talk to Peter Horrocks and find out what their plans are and what the digital aspect of this is. So Peter Horrocks is the director of BBC's Global News Division, responsible for leading the BBC's international news services across radio, TV, and new media. He previously was head of TV news from September 2005 until BBC News went multimedia in November 2007. At that time, he became head of BBC's multimedia newsroom. He's also been the head of BBC's head of current affairs and has been with the BBC since 1981. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we were talking about, you know, this effort by, you know, the BBC and other British outlets like The Guardian and others to kind of capture more of an American audience. And now you have this deal with Comcast to really do that on the TV side. What drives you guys to really put this much effort into American audience?
Well, we believe in our journalism. We believe in doing strong, independent journalism from around the world, a real global view. And we want to bring that to as large an audience as possible around the world. Our audiences have been growing in the United States, particularly through World Service, through public radio, also through the BBC's website, bbc.com. Growing through PBS, our programs go out on PBS, but direct distribution through television is really crucial. We get revenue from that, but the most important thing is to make sure that the quality of news which we believe the BBC provides is as widely available as possible.
And what's been the holdup on this so far? Why has it taken so long to get carriage? Is it just the number of people just fighting to get carriage on all these cable channels? Why has it been so difficult?
Well, I know this program talks a lot about the cable industry, and it's a famously difficult kind of commercial market. So we've put together a good package alongside the BBC's entertainment and factual channel in the US, BBC America, and by bringing the best of the BBC both in news and in other genres together, working effectively with our partners, we've managed to build our distribution. And I think that the BBC brand is growing in the United States, and our partners Comcast, I think, have realized that. And there's been very, very strong positive reaction to it in those markets where BBC World News is going to be available, it's been welcomed. And in other places where we're not yet, it's not yet been agreed, people have said, you know, give me my BBC. So that's encouraging for us.
One of the things that sort of led Americans and to be interested in international news was Arab Spring and other things that came out of that, that people wanted more news out of it instead of CNN and other outlets here. Al Jazeera was, of course, famously the example. How much of what you're trying to sort of achieve here is driven by international events that you guys have deep franchise expertise in?
That's definitely an important part of it, and as well as the BBC's English language news, which your listeners will probably be most aware of, another arm of the BBC is its language services, similar to the Voice of America. We have 27 different language services, and we integrate those all together in a sort of single news offering. So we think that a time when there are increasingly important global trends and global stories, and I think the global economic crisis at the moment is probably the strongest example of that, the ability of a news organization like the BBC, with 80 years of heritage and international coverage, is to bring the perspectives from all different parts of the world, from journalists who come from those countries that we're reporting from and to, and to bring that all together, package it up, and provide a level of insight based on news gathering resource that many US news organizations now unfortunately lack. And we think that's a real winning combination.
In terms of your push online, and this was a thing that I noticed, especially over the last year, you were putting on these live feeds when there was big breaking news, not just Arab Spring, but also, as you said, the economic crisis, also the Murdoch controversies in UK, and you were putting live feeds for free for people to watch. What was the response there, and what were the learnings, and did that in any way influence the TV side of it?
Well, I'm glad that you've noticed that. It's certainly an area of real experimentation and innovation for us. So I think what that's doing is taking some of the lessons from television-based breaking news, rapid delivery, regular updating of the story, going with pieces of information which may not yet have a complete picture, and trying to do that and bringing that to life in digital. And I think, you know, for many years, websites have felt quite static. And what we want to do is to try and inject some dynamism into it, to be able to use that unique resource of original journalism that we've got through the thousands of journalists that the BBC has across the world. And those live pages, live blogs, with video as well in some cases, can really bring stories to life. And one of the things that we're working on, and we've started experimenting in beta for this, is not just to do it on single stories, but to have a single stream of all of our breaking news information, and also offering that as a curation service to the depth of analysis that the BBC offers. Because, of course, it's not just breaking news. It's really important that you add understanding for audiences. So that's a key area for innovation for us in the months ahead.
So what you mean by that is you will not just simulcast the BBC News World News 24/7 channel, but would be a sort of a package that's separate from that on the web.
Yes, the live TV channel is obviously part of subscription packages through our partners, and for rights reasons, and also to kind of protect its exclusivity, we don't stream that channel consistently. So what we're doing with both text, recorded video, breaking news straps, graphics, etc., is to create a TV-like, I suppose, or at least create that sense of visual dynamism that television has, but not with the full streaming channel. And then by making that available and then making it clear to people that if they want the full channel, they can go to that, then they get that through a more conventional television subscription environment.
So for us, the cord cutters who aren't going to have Comcast or any cable service, I guess we're kind of out of luck if we want to see the streams.
I'm afraid, yes, I know it's one of your favorite subjects, called cord cutting. BBC World News is available through your authorized subscriber. But the full flavor of BBC News is available for free online. We're not adopting any pay approach on our digital platforms, so the BBC website, but also our apps and our other products are all completely free. Our apps are not charged for, but the television offer is behind that paywall.
And so is part of the reason that you do that, is that because of the contracts you sign with cable companies, or is it your own philosophy just as the BBC to do that?
It's those two things together. I think there is something about having your strongest and most vivid product, and if you can monetize that and use that to feed back into your journalism, I think you need to make sure that you're running it as a business. But in terms of our approach to digital and the fact that that's not got a pay element, I think that's partly about philosophy, but also what we think is most successful in commercial terms as well. I mean, one of the things we haven't touched on, and it's sometimes slightly perplexing to people in the United States, is how the BBC works. And we have a variety of funding sources. We're paid for directly by the UK audience, the license fee payer. We have an element paid for by the UK government. And then the services we're talking about here, BBC World News and BBC.com, are commercial services. And those commercial elements need to stand on their own feet. They're both profit centres, and they're both profit-making for us. And our advertising approach is through branded global sales to upscale audiences whom clients wish to reach. So we maximize all those different sources of revenue, but we bring them together, united by BBC values that have been established over many decades, and then use that unified editorial product and maximize its distribution and its commercial return across as many platforms as possible.
So, speaking of the channels, the deal that you did with Comcast, for now it's in specific markets. What are the plans in trying to tie up with others, especially on the East Coast and West Coast, where just on the face of it, you would think would be a much larger audience than other places. And then following that, I would have a question on the coverage of U.S. news and sort of, are you, especially with the elections coming up next year, what are your plans on ramping that up within the BBC News TV channel?
Okay, so the distribution that we've announced, key markets, Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, Minneapolis, Portland, etc., and also San Francisco and Michigan, obviously, we want to add to those, and it's important to get as wide a national distribution as possible. Clearly, we're talking to other operators and other platforms. Being able to be on satellite would be attractive to us, and to get as larger a national penetration as possible. So we see this as a stepping stone and some real momentum, which obviously we want to build on. Our teams act, I suppose, as a kind of interface between US audiences and US stories in the world. And what we know our audience wants is an international perspective, but sometimes tailoring that, explaining issues so that they're comprehensible from a US perspective. That's what those teams focus on, as well as generating some original content, which is the US seen through a kind of slightly quizzical international eye. So, for instance, we recently did a special feature about the prevalence of child abuse in America. Maybe with a sensibility and an approach that some US news organizations may have slightly shied away from. That was certainly the reaction of our audiences to that investigative feature.
Yeah, it's interesting how we do appreciate having kind of an outside view of our own affairs, and that we are, you know, sometimes we do feel like we're not necessarily getting the best coverage from our own services and our own journalism outfits. And so, you know, I wonder if that's why there's been such a popularity of things like the BBC's website in the US and the Guardian's website and all these outside websites that get so much traffic from us.
Well, we hope that kind of alternative perspective, which we absolutely put forward as an objective global perspective, sometimes feels very different from the offers that are available in the US market. And of course, famously, news in the US, certainly on the cable channels, has become more opinionated. The BBC deliberately eschews that. You know, we have very strong public mandate to produce entirely objective and, as far as one can, impartial news. But of course, by doing that, that can provide a different perspective for US audiences. I should say there are some US audiences who say, well, you know, keep your nose out of our business. But, you know, it's our job to look at the world as clear-sightedly and as impartially as we can. And we appreciate US audiences who are attracted to that.
So now, you know, we talk about cord cutting here and this whole idea of dropping cable and satellite. Does something like that exist in the UK? Is there a movement of people or young people who just decide they don't want to get it at all?
It's not taken off to quite the extent as I've heard it debated on this show, but it's certainly there. And over the top operators, Netflix, Love Film are starting to make some progress. The consumption of on demand video content in the UK is very high. That's largely been driven by the BBC's own innovation in this area through the product, the BBC iPlayer, which is available on a number of platforms, so available on desktops, but also on tablets, but also on a variety of console devices, and has been wildly successful. And on-demand viewing as a whole in the UK, is extremely high, but that's having less of an impact in terms of pure cord cutting because of the different business model that the BBC has, i.e. that content for UK citizens is all provided for free.
Thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate you coming on and talking with us.
Thanks. It was a really stimulating conversation. I appreciate it.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about the ReadWrite Web. They just sold the site. Richard McManus had started ReadWrite Web as kind of a tech news site, but with a little bit more of a view of culture and kind of participatory web. I mean, just the whole idea of a ReadWrite Web. I mean, that's something from about, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, where, you know, we started talking about kind of Web 2.0. I guess I associate them with that movement a little bit. He's in New Zealand. They're kind of a virtual type of organization. We've had Marshall Kirkpatrick on our show before, who's one of the longtime editors there, who's now, I guess, left to do kind of a startup and is only there part-time. They've sold it for $5 million, or what, you know, is reported to be $5 million, to Say Media, which is kind of a roll-up in itself between the startups Video Egg and Six Apart merged to create Say Media, and they've decided to start rolling up different sites. You know, they've got Remodelista, and now they've got ReadWrite Web, and, you know, who knows what they'll buy next. But this is something we've seen before as far as this kind of roll up strategy to buy and create a network of content sites. I mean, what do you think about this deal?
Yeah, I think I'm a big fan of Richard, and I remember when I first met him, he's probably the most humble, wonkiest blog mogul you will see. He has very little ego, when egos are a huge part of this whole ecosystem, as you know this well. So that's why I was happy that he did have a acquisition thing. He's also built it from New Zealand, which is very unlikely in the sort of US and US centric blog world. So, and there was a bunch of reaction yesterday. About how a bunch of the writers have left and stuff. They have been shopping it for a while. I sort of, some people pinged me yesterday that told me that they were looked at by a few other players in the market. So I don't know if they officially hired a bank to do it or they were just doing it by themselves. But it certainly was being shopped for the last few months.
Yeah, and then they also announced that Dan Frommer, who was at Business Insider, is now going to be their new editor at large, and that they're, I guess, going to expand what their coverage is and try to do even more of what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess now they have the money. Say Media has raised a bunch of money. They generate a bunch of money through advertising. I mean, they're kind of like federated media in the sense that they started as initially was a blog ad network, and then now they're buying properties or creating their own properties. So not just and then layering advertising. I mean, Video Egg was video advertising platform. Six Apart, which they bought, was a blog network through their Typepad. It's interesting that they've, from what I understand, Say Media has completely ditched the movable type part of Six Apart that you and I know very well.
Yeah, that actually runs MediaShift. So
that does run MediaShift. So you probably know it better than I do. But yeah. They've sort of stopped developing it or releasing, but they're focusing on the Typepad part of it.
Right.
Which is the equivalent to WordPress.com platform that WordPress has. And so their focus is, besides selling ads and helping people get on the platforms, can we then own these platforms, own the content as well? So as part of that, I think Read Write Web is one. The others that you mentioned, others. And I am guessing that if the paid content people haven't pitched their books to, say, media, they probably are after they heard about this yesterday. The bankers that are shopping paid content, which I don't know if I'm sure this doesn't come as news to anybody, but Guardian is looking to sell paid content.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Glam Media, TechCrunch was kind of saying, you know, they had like an interesting little, I think it was Eric Schoenfeld who had kind of an interesting little analysis about what Say Media is trying and kind of, you know, parallel to something like Glam Media, you know, this like ad network where, you know, you're just an ad network and, well, why not have some content sites? Because if you know, the ad network can only sell ads for so much CPM, but, you know, if you have high quality content, your CPM is going to be higher. And so maybe that raises the overall rate of what you can sell. I don't know. You know, I still wonder about this strategy. You know, Gawker seems like they've been the strongest as far as being this kind of network of different sites where they controlled everything from the start. But, you know, I just wonder whether this kind of strategy, yeah, everyone seems to have tried it. AOL's trying it now. But, you know, how much success have any of these people had overall?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think there's going to be a consolidation. A bunch of these brands are probably going to end up consuming one or the other.
How many blogs do we need, really?
Yeah, and I mean, of course, everybody is an ad network. At the end of the day, all of these companies are glorified ad networks, whatever they want to say. Glam is a prime example of that. Federated is another example of that. Say Media is to some extent an example of that. And these are just ad networks that are trying to then now sort of move up the value chain. So anyway, we can keep talking about that forever.
We probably will. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was these polls that we've done lately at MediaShift that have been getting a lot of response. I'd say, you know, this one poll we had asking, you know, what do you think about cord cutting with you know, which has obviously been the big subject for us, had probably the most responses we've ever had of any poll. I think there were 1,200 or 1,300 votes on it, and 45% of the people answered that poll said they were happy that they cut the cord to cable. 31% said that they would quit cable if they had the right alternative and felt like they could find their
31%
shows.
31% they said?
Well, who are on cable but would quit. And only 2% said that they love cable and would never quit. And I guess 2% quit, cut the cord, and then went back to cable. So, I mean, that's a pretty, you know, that is a huge amount of people that are saying, you know, they're into it. And you know, we never really see many numbers on people cord cutting. It's always talked about as, oh, that's anecdotal evidence. It's not really happening. I don't know that this is anything more than that. Some people have kind of accused, you know, some of the stuff we do on MediaShift. They say, oh, well, you know, that's a PBS audience. Those people don't care about cable as much. They can get PBS over the air. I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to get a handle on really what is it that gets people so excited about the subject. You know, I mean, they hate cable, they hate satellite, they do want an alternative, and whether they've cut the cord or not, obviously there's a huge, almost like what you'd call a pent-up demand for people who are waiting for the right moment to cut it, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, people are paying money for cable. They would want to not pay money for cable. I think that's really one part of it.
Or pay a reasonable amount. You know, I think that's what it comes down to, right?
Yeah, I mean, they look at satellite, or they look at sort of, I don't know, internet stuff, a lot of stuff for free, and they say, why are we paying so much for it? And I think that's part of it, is driving that. I think TV and cable is safe for a long, 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 long time to come, but of course these are movements that are happening, and we've seen numbers go up and down about how many people are cutting, and some people are saying those numbers are wrong and this and that. But the reality is, if you just look at your kids now, you will see what the future is. So I think that's the end all be all of it, and we've talked about it so much that I don't even know what to say now.
Yeah, we don't say anymore. So the other poll was, last week we had Brian Lamb on to talk about kind of gadgets to get for the holidays, and so we did a poll asking what gadget people want the most to get as a gift, and 33% said they wanted an iPad, 18% said they wanted a Kindle Fire, 9% wanted a smartphone. Well, just 5% wanted a Nook tablet, and 14% said they didn't want to get any gadgets. There were a lot of people who just kind of had their own thoughts of things that they wanted. There were a lot of people saying they wanted Android tablets. Some people wanted the new Nexus. Somebody said they wanted peace and quiet. So there's a pretty funny mix of responses to that one.
Should launch something peace and quiet.
The peace and quiet device, the cone of silence or something.
Playbook, BlackBerry playbook. We don't do anything. That's why we're peace and quiet. We're peace and quiet.
Exactly.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Along with my co-host, Rafat Ali, we want to thank our guest, Peter Horrocks from BBC, and PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/Idealab. We'll catch you next week for a year-end special.